Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, September 11, a very sad anniversary in our nation's history. Last night, President Obama spoke to the nation on Syria, and this hour, an analysis of what he said with Professor Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of many books on national security from World War II to the war on terrorism, political history, and U.S. presidents, including George W. Bush, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, LBJ, and more. Presidential speeches, he says, are rarely able to fundamentally reshape public opinion. Obama, he wrote yesterday, must give his strongest effort if he doesn't want to end up in an embarrassing situation for his administration and one that could undercut the military effort that he is proposing. From his speech last night, here's the president.
If we fail to act, the Assad regime will see no reason to stop using chemical weapons. As the ban against these weapons erodes, other tyrants will have no reason to think twice about acquiring poison gas and using them. Over time, our troops would again face the prospect of chemical warfare on the battlefield. And it could be easier for terrorist organizations to obtain these weapons and to use them to attack civilians.
Professor Julian Zelizer is with us to analyze the president's important address last night, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, our email talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page. People are already leaving messages there. Feel free to go there, and we'll read those as well. It is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Zelizer, hello, and nice to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me.
We played a little clip, but as I think about his speech last night, he didn't go much beyond that in answering one of the basic questions that you said he had to answer. Why are we entering this conflict?
That's absolutely true. It was an odd speech in that, you know, it started originally as a speech that was going to try to sway public opinion, mobilize congressional support behind military intervention. And then because of what happened, within the 24 hours that preceded the speech, it also became about how he was not going to go to war and give this diplomatic option some chance. So some of the bigger message, I think, was lost that he might have otherwise delivered. Why this is important, how Syria fits into a bigger picture of what he hopes to accomplish on foreign policy, and some picture for Americans of the larger mission that might help them understand why this is important. I don't really think that was part of the speech, and my guess is many Americans are left where they were, you know, before he delivered it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Put this in a bit of a historical context. I liked one of the articles you wrote when you talked about what our mission was in the 30s and 40s, then the 40s through the 80s, and then 2011, the anniversary that we mark today, until today. What was it? What was our mission in fighting then, and what is it now?
Well, I think in each of the major eras of U.S. history, even though many people disagreed on whether it was correct or how to do it, there were themes that foreign policy focused around. So the fight against fascism dominated debates in the 1930s. The fight against communism dominated debates from the 1940s to the 1980s. Then there was a fight against rogue states that was much more short-lived during the 1990s, such as Iraq. And obviously since 9/11, it's been the fight against kind of stateless terrorist networks. And I think those are the most powerful themes that we've heard policymakers articulate, and it's been a way of explaining why this particular battle matters or another battle doesn't matter. I'm not sure where we're in. Obviously, that still looms very large, and the fight against terrorism is a strong one. But I do think President Obama and other policymakers are scrambling to explain where we are now and certainly how Syria fits into that.
You also wrote in that same column that if humanitarian interventions are to become a new norm, the president should make the case and offer a set of coherent principles for future conflicts. He mentioned last night the use of chemical weapons that U.S. Army GIs succumbed to in World War I, the Nazis' use of gas in their torture chambers, and the century work that was going on to ban the use of those chemical weapons. Did he, it seemed to me, as, and then he talked in great detail about how horrible it is to die and the number of children who have died from these kinds of weapons. It, was that a focal point? Is that what he was talking about? We simply must respond on humanitarian grounds to rid the world from using these weapons ever again?
Well, it was part of the speech. It's certainly been part of the message the administration has been making since there was a move toward a military strike. And obviously the release of those videos in the last few days was also meant to convey that point. Many of his advisors, like Samantha Powers, have been strong advocates since the 90s of the argument that the U.S. has to get involved in humanitarian issues, and that when chemicals, weapons, and other weapons of mass destruction are being used like this, the United States has to intervene. It was part of his message, but I don't think it was a particularly powerful way to deliver it. And he has to answer the question of when, how do we distinguish when the United States is going to address these issues, as opposed to many other humanitarian crises where the U.S. does nothing. And he sends a mixed signal in saying we can't have chemical weapons used. Assad is a dangerous leader who, you know, treats his own people horribly. But then there's other messages. This is going to be a limited strike and will basically allow him to continue ruling. So if he wants to make a kind of full-throated defense of humanitarian intervention, I think he has to do it in a different way and use some of the power, his rhetorical power that he's shown on other issues, to explain to Americans why this has to be front and center.
He appeared to say, correct me if you think it was another thing that he was saying, that the United States is the only nation on earth that would step up to the plate here, that we're the only ones capable of doing what needs to be done. Did you hear it that way?
A little bit. I mean, I think that's more defensive, and I think he's trying to explain why he's doing this without much support. He finds himself in this awkward position of almost acting unilaterally when he himself was such a critic of President Bush for going to wars without much international support. And so the stepping up to the plate is a familiar argument. Sometimes it's true, but sometimes it's also an argument when there's a lot of skepticism about what the United States is doing. And it kind of gives a more heroic explanation for the intervention and a way to allay public concerns about why other countries, including England, are not behind this.
Mm-hmm. What about what he said concerning the plan for Syria to surrender their stockpiles of chemical weapons? An interesting piece in the Times this afternoon that it grew out of conversations between Obama and Putin going back them more than a year. And here we thought that it was just off the cuff, that Kerry brought this up in a news conference and the Russians picked up on it. It evidently has been discussed for quite some time.
Oh, that's very believable, and often these, you know, diplomatic breakthroughs are just that. They are breakthroughs. They happen at the last minute. They happen when we are at the cusp of going to war. I don't know if Kerry actually did say that in an offhand manner, or it was more staged than that as an effort to get the administration out of this jam. But right now, that is the focus of what the administration is doing, and they're hoping to define the terms of this agreement. That's very important, not just in terms of verifying whether the Syrians are complying, but explaining to the Syrians, to the international community, and to American voters what we're expecting, how we're going to measure whether this agreement is working or not. And I think of all the things he said last night, that's the most important part of the puzzle. It's something that's been in the works for a while. That's not a surprise. This is what Obama's preference would be. Mm-hmm. He does not want to go to war. But now the question is, how do you put it together so it's believable and that it seems like it is legitimate and working and not simply some kind of a ruse that leaves us in the same problem, you know, 1 month later?
And yet his comments about the UN have hardly been laudatory over the past few months. It's not as though he was suggesting some time ago the United Nations really needs to stand up here and we need to work through an international forum to address this horror.
He didn't. And again, in part, I think that's because he doesn't have that support right now. And he's very aware of that. You know, again, a very important part of his presidency And his rhetoric has been about the need for international cooperation on these kinds of issues and why it is beneficial for the United States to find ways to address crises such as Syria through international alliances. I do think he truly believes that, and his advisors believe that, but he's in a position right now where he doesn't have that. And so he's been very critical, and he's also been a bit defensive, including the remarks you've mentioned, about why he doesn't have that in this operation. And so, you know, this is a president who finds himself looking sometimes like the president he had defeated or he replaced many years ago and who he had been strongly critical of.
Well, it didn't get off to a great start. The UN Security Council session canceled yesterday, Russia clashing with the United States and France over to whether to make this proposal binding and back it up with a threat of force. These are going to be some tough negotiations, aren't they? Do you see any promise?
You know, at this point, I don't know. They're going to be very tough negotiations. There is a sense that the Syrians don't want to get involved in a full-scale war, though. So in some ways, the question, the most important question at this point is, what are the Syrians willing to give up? I do think they're worried about some kind of U.S.-Israeli alliance that takes forceful action and knocks out certainly chemical weapons capacity, if not the regime itself. I don't think the fear of that should be taken lightly. And I don't think Assad is convinced that the United States won't react. So ultimately, that's going to be a big part of the negotiations, and this is incumbent on Syria, not just the international community in the U.S., of showing that they want a different path than a full-scale military war right now.
You said that the president needed to demonstrate to the public that his decision is based on the soundest of evidence. Did he present that last night?
I don't think he did. You know, I think that's part of the skepticism the public here in the United States expresses, is it's not irrational. This is a country that's been tricked many times before by their own presidents. This dates back decades. And, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin is one example that people learn about in school, where there wasn't really the attack described on the United States, but an alleged attack is used as the basis for expanding Lyndon Johnson's power to use force in Vietnam. President George W. Bush obviously used faulty intelligence to support the war in Iraq regarding weapons of mass destruction. And so many Americans are nervous. They don't believe what they see. They see horrible images, but they're not quite convinced, you know, who's responsible for that. And so the president really needs to do more work, I believe, including in Congress, at presenting an absolutely airtight case that this is Syria, the Syrian government that is doing this, not the rebels, and that the risks he is arguing exist to the citizenry of Syria and to the region are very real. And I think he understands this, but I do think the memory of Iraq, if not Vietnam, still loom large in this public, and he has to address that.
I don't think we have a very good understanding, and I would hope that the president does, but I don't think we have a very good understanding as to who the opposition is in Syria and whether or not there are a whole lot of al-Qaeda elements in the opposition. We're supposedly supporting the Free Syrian Army. How much do we know about them? We heard yesterday from humanitarian workers in Turkey that there were raids of camps there from Free Syrian Army members to round up any men who might be available to fight. And the whole thing seems kind of murky without any clear good guys.
Well, I'm certainly not a foreign international relations expert, but I think you are 100% correct. And the administration had decided not to intervene in this war for many years now, when there were many atrocities being reported on. Part of the problem was the confusion over who the rebels were and the different factions that existed within the rebel organizations. And so I don't think a lot of the American public is exactly clear on what the fight is about, what the different sides are, and if the Assad regime is knocked out, who would replace them. And given that kind of confusion and given the lack of a bigger context for this kind of a war, very different than trying to knock out Al-Qaeda, for example, or a cell of Al-Qaeda, I think it's very hard to convince Americans and legislators to say, sure, we'll give you the authority you want on this.
Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest this hour, and we're examining what the president had to say in his address to the nation on Syria last night. What did you think of what the president had to say last night? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Here's what the president had to say about what Secretary of State John Kerry's plans for tomorrow will be.
I'm sending Secretary of State John Kerry to meet his Russian counterpart on Thursday, and I will continue my own discussions with President Putin. I've spoken to the leaders of two of our closest allies, France and the United Kingdom, and we will work together in consultation with Russia and China to put forward a resolution at the UN Security Council requiring Assad to give up his chemical weapons and to ultimately destroy them under international control. We'll also give UN inspectors the opportunity to report their findings about what happened on August 21st. And we will continue to rally support from allies from Europe to the Americas, from Asia to the Middle East, who agree on the need for action. Meanwhile, I've ordered our military to maintain their current posture, to keep the pressure on Assad, and to be in a position to respond if diplomacy fails.
We go to your phone calls, 800-486-8655, our number, and Daniel in Madison is our first caller. Hi, Daniel. Hello? I don't know where you are, Daniel. Call back. Scott in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi there, Kathleen. Thanks again for a wonderful program. Professor, I somewhere this morning on public radio heard a story that, or a small comment that there is supposedly a German newspaper or news outlet of some kind that has reported that the gas attack last month was not actually something that Assad had ordered, but that it was done at a lower level. And if that's the case, then, I would just have to think that's the scariest scenario of them all. Even his removal doesn't prevent this kind of thing from happening again. Had you heard anything about that?
I heard that, Scott, too, last week sometime. Professor, have you heard that?
Yeah, I think The Guardian had a report on that a couple days ago, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you know, the frightening possibility about chemical weapons or other kinds of weapons is that they're not just in the hands of the one leader who's in power at the time. Lower-level leaders might be able to gain access to them and use them, break off fractions of a government could ultimately gain hold of the opposition in this case, can take over and use those weapons against new populations. So, ultimately the goal is to eradicate the presence of those chemical weapons altogether because they are not easily controllable. And I think that report reveals a very frightening reality about how these are often deployed.
Scott, what did you think of the president last night?
Well, I came away with this feeling like it might have been, pardon the expression, mission accomplished moment in that, if Assad really had control of this situation and ordered this attack, I was sitting there thinking, would he be likely now to do it again? And I have a feeling that he probably would not.
Mm-hmm.
But going into this before anything happened, whole initiative by the Russians came up. And by the way, I think this might be Putin's attempt to get a Nobel Peace Prize. You know, he's already got a Super Bowl ring. Now he can go for that. I had read someplace, and I thought that the most effective thing that the Congress could authorize the president to do, and I saw an article that said think tank person in D.C. had said this would very definitely be part of any attack on Assad. Would be a cyber attack, where we wouldn't have to put boots on the ground. We wouldn't even have to put missiles in the air, but we would just degrade his military. I mean, obviously, we were well wired on him because if we've got copies of the communications, it's going between between Assad's generals. We certainly seemingly could get in there and do a Stuxnet type attack on his cyber setup.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, that would send a message in its own little way, don't you think?
Professor Zelizer?
Well, it depends what we're trying to do. And I think, you know, the argument that part of what the president needed to do in the speech is articulate the mission is an important one. And obviously one mission is to knock out chemical weapons capability. That's probably going to be hard to do through cyber warfare. The other is just to upset the Assad regime, to undercut it, even to foment the rebellion that's taking place. And we don't know. The other argument is that limited airstrikes would be sufficient if ending the chemical weapons program is what we're looking for. The problem with these wars is that they are unpredictable and that the objectives are stated. And if the mission, though, is not, you know, very precise, the war opens up once it's in place. And so it might be fine to hope and think cyber warfare would be the primary mechanism through which we attack the regime. But once we're doing that, it could require much more of a commitment. And that's what we saw in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that's part of the fear a lot of legislators have right now.
Thanks, Scott, for the call. Daniel in Madison, hi.
Hi. My concern with the speech, and I'm pretty upset with President Obama, what he had to say about the children who were gassed and who can't imagine how terrible that was, and you can even see it. But I know, knowing something about history, the United States standing by and actually helping the Hussein regime during the Iran-Iraq war, helping Hussein's forces target gas things against the Iranian soldiers. But also, I think he's on pretty flimsy moral ground when he uses drone strikes. How many children have been killed as collateral damage? I mean, I voted for Obama, and I'm very disappointed in his use of power. I think it's even worse than Bush and Cheney. And, you know, this is 9/11 for the United States 12 years ago, but it's also 40 years ago for Chile and the havoc that we wreaked in that country by our activity. So I get really annoyed with all this and the American people who don't even know their own history.
Professor Zelizer, thanks, Daniel.
That's actually, you know, that's a longstanding criticism of anyone, any politician who argues that humanitarian objectives should be central to our policy or that human rights even should be central to our policy. And the argument is that in most regions of the world, the United States have been and remain very inconsistent, that we often support authoritarian regimes who do terrible things to their populations, even as we're saying that we're fighting for democracy in other parts of the world. That we support governments that use weapons such as Syria have just employed, even while calling on others not to use them. And that kind of inconsistency leads to this kind of argument.
Mm-hmm.
With President Obama, it's a very specific complaint here that was just raised about the use of drone strikes, which have been in the media for some time now, at least a year, very aggressive use of drone strikes by President Obama. And here he is complaining about the tactics of the Syrian government. This is an area where many liberals on the left agree with this argument, and many pragmatist conservatives of the Henry Kissinger variety also say this is why humanitarian interests shouldn't really be central to public policy, because we'll never really follow through on that.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been a debate that's been going on at least since the 1960s. And in some ways, this is an opportunity for Obama to explain what he means and how we can avoid that inconsistency and use Syria as an example of how we could do this the right way and how we could create some order in our different public policies so we're not doing two things at once. He hasn't really done that yet, and I think that leads to the kind of skepticism you just heard from the caller.
And the caller didn't mention Vietnam and our use of napalm and Agent Orange in Vietnam. The president didn't mention the fact that there are 13,000 tons of chemical weapons still left in other countries and that we still have a lot of chemical weapons. You know, we're not, if you're going to take this kind of action, perhaps you do need to remember the history. And I don't know if you say anything about it or not, but there are other issues that are important in making decisions.
Well, the other strategy is just a more realistic argument or a more pragmatic argument that, you know, the current government of Syria poses a threat to the region or poses a threat to our interests in the region and has to be removed. That's not very satisfying to a lot of people, and it sounds much crasser, but it does avoid some of the arguments that you inevitably get into when you make more principled claims about intervention. President George W. Bush faced the same problem when he made arguments about going to war in Iraq to try to spread freedom and to try to spread democracy. It was the same criticism you heard there that you're hearing now with Syria.
Mm-hmm. Our number, a couple lines are open now, 800-486-8655 is our number. Here's an email from Gary in Glendale. President Obama appears to walk softly while carrying a big stick. The U.S. president, of course, who coined this was Theodore Roosevelt, who's been generally recognized as a successful leader despite his brutal repression of Filipino freedom fighters. Isn't it quite possible that the rushing willingness to intervene and force Syria to give up its chemical weapons and tactics as a result of prolonged discussion between Putin and Obama is successful diplomacy achieved confidentially outside the public eye?
Well, yes. You know, most diplomacy takes place that way. And, you know, the notion that you have a spotlight on diplomacy contradicts how much of this has usually happened. It is behind the scenes. It is often between adversaries who reach agreements that in public would be impossible, but privately are very palatable to both sides of the aisle, so to speak. I have no idea if that was the case here or what's been going on, but, you know, this is the tradition of backroom diplomacy. This is how it's often been conducted. But right now, we don't have evidence that's taken place. Another way you have diplomacy is through very public statements, where each side says what they're looking for with hope that the other country will come to an agreement because of what they're hearing, frankly, in the press or what they're hearing from the president.
Mike in Elm Grove, hi.
Hi. I just want to say that as an 80-year-old, I'm very, very proud of our president for his course of action, standing up to the Russians and yet working out diplomatically. I don't care if it takes years to settle. He's our peace president. We've been waiting for him for 100 years since Teddy Roosevelt, and I hope that the conservatives and everybody else can get behind this good man. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, President Professor Zelizer.
Well, yes, I think there that sentiment's been expressed by some of his supporters. If he is able to carry this out, I think he can turn what was a very messy situation into an advantage, meaning this is, in some ways, what he argued has to happen. You have to be deliberative about foreign policy crises. You have to move very slowly into war. You have to take the same kind of risks that you do with war with diplomatic initiatives. Both involve risks, and there's no reason that diplomatic initiatives such as this should be sidetracked because they're just too dangerous. And if he can pull this off, if it comes together, if the chemical weapons program becomes dismantled through this route, I think, you know, this could become something that historians and the public remember positively about President Obama, offering a different path. Obviously, this will still contradict what another caller talked about, the use of drone strikes, very aggressive drone strikes against al-Qaeda targets, the continued buildup of the national security system under Obama. He's not really a peace president. I think that would be incorrect. But this could be certainly a moment that resonates and that looks more like what Americans expected in 2008 than all the NSA stories and the drone strike stories we've been hearing for the last 6 months.
Professor Zelizer, why is it, do you think, that he went to Congress with this? I mean, obviously, he's having a hard time convincing all kinds of people, loyal Democratic supporters, Republicans, the American public. The numbers on this are just abysmal for him. So what was he thinking? Why did he do that?
Well, part it wasn't choice. I think he was backed into this. I think he was hoping this would move swiftly, that public support and congressional support would line up very quickly. But it was clear, especially after the parliament in England said no to Cameron, that he was going to be having problems here in the United States, and that Congress certainly was not supportive of this. And I think it was an effort to show he was not alone, that he was not simply sending U.S. troops or Air Force power into a conflict without any kind of support. This is a problem for any president, but it was particularly a problem for President Obama, given everything he stood for and talked about since he's run, and even before that, you know, since 2006 and 2007. The second reason is I do believe that he thinks Congress should be part of the decision-making process. He's talked about this for years, and I think he would fundamentally be uncomfortable if he did this without any kind of congressional resolution of support. The difference with what we've seen in recent years was that he came to Congress after the announcements had been made and after it seemed that he was clear he was going to do this. It was almost as if he came to Congress too late, before all the support was lined up. So it created this very awkward, intense moment.
John in Janesville.
Hello.
Hi, John.
How are you doing?
All right, John, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, after the last person, Bush, got us into a war that was illegal and said that it was only going to take 2 or 3 days, tops, maybe a week, and it would cost us absolutely nothing, and it bankrupted us, where are we supposed to be getting the money from for this one?
Professor Zelizer?
Well, we don't know what kind of war it will be. So obviously what happened in previous operations isn't necessarily going to happen here. It could be a quick strike. It could be more like what we saw in Bosnia or Kosovo in the 1990s, where the costs are not huge to the United States, and this doesn't have a huge impact on the federal budget or even on American military personnel. Obviously, if we conduct some kind of strike and this just opens up more problems that necessitate more intervention, who knows, even some kind of ground presence, then the question of money arises. That's one of the hardest parts of military action. The first is obviously the human dimension, the casualties. But another big dimension from Washington's perspective is, how do you pay for it? And this is something the president's worried about every day right now because of all the debates going on the budget. But I do think the administration thinks this can be contained, this can be relatively quick, and it's not clear they're aspiring to do very much. In some ways, I think what they want to do right now is to display a show of force and get out of there. That wouldn't be very costly. But as the caller says, these things take unpredictable turns.
Let me ask you to analyze a couple other points in the president's speech, Professor Zelizer. He talked about this as being a danger to our security. There would be no reason to stop other tyrants who have chemical weapons from using them. Our troops could face these kinds of weapons when they're in the battlefield. Terrorists could have the ability, although I was wondering, as he was saying that, maybe they already have these weapons because Al-Qaeda's on the ground in Syria as well. But their ability to obtain weapons is a threat to our national security. Were those all valid points?
Well, the spread or presence of chemical weapons in that region is a danger. And if that region is dangerous, we face a danger because we do have interest there, from economic interest to strategic interest. And I think anyone on any side of the political spectrum could agree on that. And it's not good for these to be in the hands, certainly, of a regime like Assad's, but also in the hands of terrorist networks or other governments like the Iranian government. The question is, will this military strike do anything about that? And I don't think he connected those two points. I think he makes a convincing case about the risks, But having a limited strike on Assad that might take out some of his chemical weapons capacity doesn't seem to solve the bigger problem, nor is it convincing yet that that would stop a country like Iran. You could easily argue this would only, you know, accelerate their program. The United States could be seen as more of a villain in the region, and the Iranian government could use that to build support behind their weapons program. If the United States is going to launch an airstrike on Syria, the Iranian government says we better increase and accelerate our military power. So it could play out in different ways, and I don't think he made a case that his solution will solve the problem.
We're talking about the president's speech to us last night on Syria, and here to talk about it with us is Professor Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He writes for CNN.com and has written all kinds of books on national security, on the war on terrorism, and also on many U.S. presidents. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Next hour of the program, it's estimated that America wastes more than 40% of the food that we produce for consumption. We'll talk with the author of American Wasteland, How America Throws Away Nearly Half of Its Food and What We Can Do About It. More calls from you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We know the Assad regime was responsible. In the days leading up to August 21st, we know that Assad's chemical weapons personnel prepared for an attack near an area where they mix sarin gas. They distributed gas masks to their troops. Then they fired rockets from a regime-controlled area into 11 neighborhoods that the regime has been trying to wipe clear of opposition forces. Shortly after those rockets landed, the gas spread, and hospitals filled with the dying and the wounded.
President Obama, from his Syria address last night, we're going back to phone calls at 800-486-8655, and Mike in Illinois is next. Hi, Mike.
Hey, good afternoon. I read online, a couple weeks, about 10 days ago, about how they are trying to make the connection in between the chemical weapons that were never found in Iraq and the chemical weapons that are in Syria now. Does the professor know any type of a link in between the two? Could this be the chemicals that were never found in Iraq? Because we gave chemicals back in the 80s to Iraq. That's why, you know, they had them in the first place, and they were never found. So could this gas actually be the United States chemical in Syria?
I'm way out of my area of expertise. I hadn't heard that, but I couldn't really comment on that.
Why isn't there an effort to, I don't know if you know this or not, but why isn't talking about humanitarian efforts, why doesn't everybody get together and say, let's get rid of all the chemical weapons material that a lot of nations seem to have. Why don't we get rid of all of it?
Well, ideally that would be what we're looking for, but that's where the realists in foreign policy would respond. That's not going to happen. Many of the people with those weapons are allies. Some of those allies want to have that kind of weapon to fight against threats to their governments, including sometimes terrorist network. So, just the history of nation states kind of pushes against those kind of international agreements. We've seen that with nuclear weapons. Everyone's against them in principle, but there's too many countries that want them in reality and practice to make those kinds of agreements really work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mike. Mike in O'Connell Falls. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, was calling to support the president, even though I'm a Republican. I listened to him a year ago when he said he had a red line. And I think the credibility of the presidency is on stake. And I thought at the same, when I heard the gas was used, I thought he should have just got the military in and did a punitive strike against the Air Force where he projects his power and indiscriminate bombing and that. And it'd all be over with. We wouldn't even have all these discussions and all this soap opera that's going on now. And I think the only one that really why the credibility of the president is really necessary, and the professor can address this, I don't agree with him. I think strength is the only thing Iran understands, and that if they think he has some credibility, they may give up their nuclear weapons. But if he has no credibility, they'll never give them up.
Professor Zelizer.
Well, on the latter point, you know, many people agree with him, and there are many advocates of some show of force, not for Syria, but for Iran. We have to remember many people said the same with Iraq, and that if there was a show of force there, it would have ripple effects on countries like Iran. That hasn't happened. So you have to at least ask the question of the U.S. having been involved in a very significant strike that actually brought down a regime, same in Afghanistan, didn't convince the Iranians to stop what they're doing. And I think those advocates have to explain why this particular strike will do what the other strikes didn't accomplish. In terms of Obama, the first comment, in terms of Obama and why didn't he just move ahead with what he had threatened to do, cross the red line and strike, I think the answer is still that there was just so much opposition. This was a president hesitant to act alone and has tried to do what many think is constitutionally correct, build public support quickly, build some kind of international support for doing this, but certainly not working without Congress, but trying to integrate both branches of government into this decision. And that's why he's done it the way he's done it. There's no immediate threat, and he still is arguing he will respond, but he wants to do it in a process that fits with what he thinks is correct.
Well, let's imagine what that process might be. It's hard not to think 2 months hence the negotiations with Russia go south. It's not going to work. The American public still isn't in favor of this. It's hard to see any indication that their minds will change. Congress is still not wholeheartedly behind this. What does he do?
Well, I think unless Syria does something else in that time period that really shocks and angers U.S. opinion, it does become harder for him. In addition to everything you said, he will then get blamed for having almost, you know, fallen for a diplomatic offer that didn't work. And conservatives will certainly rail against him for, you know, vacillating and not showing the kind of firm leadership that should be expected of the commander-in-chief. And it will only become that much harder to mobilize public opinion. At that time, he can ask Congress for support again. He could still strike without congressional support. He has the ability to do that. Presidents have done that since 1950, and he could be much less cooperative with Congress. Or even more cynically, by then, you know, his own interest in doing anything might dissipate. And if the national agenda moves on to other issues like the budget or health care, a cynic could say that President Obama will just not want to return to this issue unless something dramatic is happening. And those are the different scenarios that could play out.
Facebook comment from Lynn. I want to hear concrete alternatives to bombing. What about an export and import embargo?
Well, I think the most concrete alternative is the one that's on the table. Some kind of international monitoring and inspection of dismantling this program. Anything else right now is purely speculative. But the alternative is that, and that's why the president took a risky step last night at basically sidetracking his speech about using military force to see if this is going to work. So that's the alternative we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Matt in Middleton. Hello.
Good afternoon. I have a few comments. First, I think that the way the president has portrayed himself on the global scene has severely damaged the view of the United States and our political representation. The way Obama responded by immediately saying he was going to bomb a country that has neither attacked us nor has said they are going to attack us, and then having Vladimir Putin being able to go on the world stage and saying, America is being the aggressor. Russia is going to be the voice for peace in the world. We're going to call for an international coalition, and we will help to alleviate this current problem. Makes the United States look severely bad from a peace initiative. We should be doing what Vladimir Putin is. Instead, Vladimir Putin's coming out and looking like Teddy Roosevelt, the good guy. I'm not saying the Russians are bad. I'm just saying that for the first time since the Soviet Union has been around, and we now just have Russia. Russia is looking like a very significant player on the world stage, and the American political influence around the world has been severely damaged. What are our alternatives now? We bomb Syria for what? We're not going to get rid of the chemical weapons. It's a save-face maneuver for the president, which looks bad to every nation in the world. It props up Russia's view to everybody else in the world. We're not applying any pressure to China. We're not applying any pressure to Israel. We're not applying any pressure to Saudi Arabia to deal with people in their backyard. We're just looking like we want to lob missiles in whenever there's a problem. And to me, that is not what the American presidency is about. It is not what the United States government stands for. And it's just frustrating for me.
Professor Zelizer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm first fascinated with the return of, you know, TR as the dove of American history. He was an aggressive supporter of the U.S. overseas and building its military power. But that's a side note. I do think at this point, President Obama certainly has not handled this well, and it's created confusion here in the country. It's probably created confusion overseas, and it did give Putin an opportunity to move from being a villain of Obama's own words into the broker of peace. And it put Obama in the position of being the aggressor, the one who wanted to strike first, Putin the one who wanted to negotiate first, which is just an odd turn of events and an odd turn of the reality of both countries. And it does, I think, in some sense, make U.S. foreign policy right now under this administration look weaker than it did just a year ago or even 2 years ago when many people were praising Obama for his foreign policy accomplishments, saying they were one of the real shining parts of what this administration was going to do. The thing is, you know, foreign policy is remade very quickly, and one success can quickly wipe out how a country is perceived and how a president is perceived. And so there still is an opportunity, even after this very strange and dramatic reversal of roles, for the United States to make this program work and to find a way to actually take away the chemical weapons without engaging in a military strike. That's the opportunity he has. I don't know if it will work, but I do think there is a way to improve a situation that clearly has not gone well in the last month.
What do you make of Secretary of State Kerry's negotiating skills and what he's had to say on all of this? Has he been doing his job well?
Well, he went from being someone just hours or days ago who was coming under intense criticism for his remarks, off-the-cuff remarks about how the United States was going to use military power, that it would be unbelievably small, to making these comments about what Syria could do to get out of this mess. All of a sudden, now he's emerging as someone whose comments were actually said on purpose, and that they were part of something that's been negotiated for a long time or thought through for a long time. Still, I don't think John Kerry appeared at his best in the last few days. I think in some ways he reflects some of the confusion of the administration about what's going on, how we're approaching this issue, and some of the vagueness in explaining the issue has to fall on the back of the Secretary of State. Very different image than we got from Secretary of State Clinton, who had emerged as one of the strongest and most forceful members of the administration. Kerry is more vacillating and in some ways fulfilling the caricature that a lot of his critics had of him when he ran for president in 2004.
Time for at least a comment. We're almost out of time. But Gloria, what do you say from Milwaukee?
Yes. About 5 months ago, it was on the BBC that Israel twice bombed Damascus. And two people heard it. First, they wouldn't comment, the Israelis. And then they did admit they did it, but they said they had a reason.
Have you heard about this, Professor Zelizer?
Syria and Israel have had a kind of very interesting relationship. It's obviously very tense, but also, in many ways, there's been a lack of conflict that you might have expected for these two countries. The Israelis have been always very clear that they're not going to tolerate any expansion of these kinds of weapons, and they've been very supportive of the strike. They've been engaged in some limited military actions against the Syrians. In general, though, they've stayed out of it now because this really is about what President Obama's administration wants to do, and they don't want to turn the focus on them.
Always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for your time, Professor Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest this hour, Professor Julian Zelizer. He's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Latest book, which is soon to be released, I believe, is on LBJ and the Great Society. We'll have to talk to him about that as soon as it is out. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produced this program. Thanks for all of your calls. Leave messages on our Facebook page if we didn't get to you at the Kathleen Dunn Show. News coming up, and we have another hour to go, so stay with us.